Good afternoon. Welcome to the Lightning Round UX Talks. We've got some awesome people talking today. So I'm Sarah Summers, and this is 10-Minute UX Ninja. So I'm about to indoctrinate all of you into the International Society of UX Ninjas. And so, of course, the main thing to remember is you have to kill crappy UX. And it's kind of a great privilege because killing is actually pretty fun as a ninja. So hang tight and feel free to, root along with this sort of silly, kind of fun lo-fi scenarios I'm going to show you guys in a bit. But of course, with any society, there are rules. And hopefully they'll pull up in a second. And there's a code to follow. First is always, sorry. I don't know if it's advancing. Sorry, guys. Sorry. I've got to be advancing. Okay. It's not advancing. Sorry, everybody. Okay. So code, just like any other society, bloodshed to all things sucky. And always have a master to train with. You always want to be learning from someone. You want to be improving your craft. And pure awesomeness is the goal. And never be afraid to kill that which needs to die. Always have your kill tools ready. You don't see Dexter Morgan fumbling with his knives because he's a ninja. So you must be prepared mentally and with all of your tools to kill bad UX on the spot when you see it. So the spinning tiger takes a few different forms. The never-ending caterpillar zigzag, the whirling dots. And that all needs to die. Why? Because it's not based in anything real. And it seems like it's never going to end, even if it takes 2 seconds. So you have to kill it. It should be time-based, percentage-based, both. And if it's on a profile or anything else you need to fill out, tell me what I need to do to move to the next level, to get to the 100% mark. I've seen this a couple times. The eye hemorrhage the client wants. And you have to kill it. And you have to get persuasive, right? You've got to tell the client something to get them to move away from something that'll actually cause, convulsions. So you have to kill it. Good nav should be dark, bold. I mean, the clear difference between Southwest and United, I mean, one is light, not compelling. One tells you exactly what you need to do and where to go. The navigation should be all caps, all lowercase, iconic if you can swing it. This is tough. It's done, right? No, you have to kill this too, because of course, when something doesn't line up and the graphics and the layout isn't consistent and they're off kilter, it looks disorganized, it doesn't look trustworthy, so hence it's entirely kill-worthy. So if you see this, it must die. So good ninjas know that you put a grid on it. Grids are actually great because it makes production and replication a lot easier, and then it definitely conveys that trust and consistency and that calming experience that you want to provide to your users. It's a bad idea. Nobody needs as many features. Just because you can do it doesn't mean you should. So if you see this, if you see feature bloat, the buckshot approach to designing a product, you have to kill it, because nothing makes people more frustrated than not knowing what the hell something does. So this is a website for a wetsuit selector. So that could get pretty complicated, but they've narrowed it down to 4 filters. The water, your size, and they've made it incredibly compelling and engaging to use. I don't even need a wetsuit, and I picked out my size. We've seen this. People love the technical error, except for it's horrible. Nobody wants to be reminded that they're actually just the ghost in the machine. So if you can avoid that Oz feeling at all cost, you have to kill this. So of course, when Tumblr went down like a million times last year, thankfully the oatmeal jumped in and saved the day and made the Tumblr beasts. And this is a brilliant way to make it a little bit more humorous. I mean, if you have to show an error, I mean, at least make it fun. And a few years ago when Flickr went down for maintenance, what did they do? Everybody popped on their Flickr site the next morning and there was a coloring contest. Perfect. Yes. No, users don't know what they want, right? They're horrible. Yes, but that doesn't mean that people like the weird crap that we like. They don't. The weird stuff, my mom doesn't play WoW. She doesn't even know. She thinks that's an expression. So we can't really make what we want. We have to sort of discover what the user wants. So I don't care if you whiteboard or wireframe, if you sketch, prototype, do something and get it in front of the users. And if you don't have access to your users, get it in front of people around you. Trust me, Rick in accounting would probably love a break. Because we're ninjas. It's not about being there, we weren't. We're the knife under the table that's there when the user needs it and disappears when they don't. And that's genius because it really gives our users confidence to keep leveling up. So the best UX ninjas know how to spy on their prey, observe and report, and watch for those habits, those desires, what motivates the user, what compels them to keep trying at something that's difficult or to keep exploring something. So that's the perfect UX ninja scenario. Because of course, the ninja is hidden in plain sight. Just like good UX, you don't realize there's a bunch of steps, you don't mind them. If it's a complex topic, it doesn't feel that way. It feels light, it feels easy. And that's it. Great UX is hidden in plain sight, just like the ninja. So, you're now indoctrinated into the International Order of UX Ninjas. Thank you.
I'm Nathan Moody, and you want to go short the clock? Show of hands, designers. Developers? Other. Thank you. So what I'm going to talk about today is conceptual design, tactics, and techniques. And I want to talk about conceptual design in terms of a specific phase in the design process that we often don't do. Usually what happens is that we pitch, we go into interaction design, visual design. And so I would like to propose that we look at how other industries do conceptual design. What conceptual design really is all about is selling your creative vision to your clients and, almost more importantly, your internal team members. It's about delivering maximum impact with design deliverables and design artifacts, but most importantly, spending the least amount of effort doing that. So finding that balance between speed as well as making sure that the fidelity level is actually kind of low in order to facilitate rapid iteration. It's about making your design principles and design thinking visible, made real, so other people can critique that, which also, of course, means that that is the core of design leadership. So I'm going to talk about our traditions and habits in the software world that might get in the way, borrowing and stealing from other industries, and then mutating and merging all that stuff together into brand new deliverables that people might not have ever seen before. So we're going to start with traditions and habits, which I kind of actually don't like. I think that a lot of our design artifacts are inappropriate for those really early stages in a project. They tend to be visually very complex, which is not great for pitching, not good on selling the vision. And I think that's a common creative problem, is going too deep into the details too quickly. All of a sudden, then you're leaving out half of the corner cases that you're inevitably going to uncover. Conversely, some of the deliverables that we give to clients and the design artifacts are really polished because we all want to leave a good impression, right? But unfortunately, early in the process, if we spend all this time presenting something and it's wrong, we have to go back and iterate again really, really quickly. So actually keeping the fidelity low is critical. But at the same time, the output of a lot of our brainstorming sessions is so rough that if you weren't in there or if you didn't take these notes, there's no way to actually parse this into any sort of creative vision. So what can we learn from other creative disciplines that could actually influence our own work? There's a bunch of them, and I want to start with one of the oldest in the world, which is writing. We can create use case scenarios and user flows, or why don't we instead chart the narrative arc of emotions of users? Why don't we talk about the social constructs of users relating to other users who maybe aren't even, or other people who aren't going to use the software? How might that influence the software that we create? Architecture is another very obvious example. Someone like Frank Gehry can't get his buildings built without computer-aided design. But you know where he starts? On paper. And Gehrygrams, as I call them, are kind of scary and strange. I think there's a bridge involved. I think there's water, and I don't know what the hell that thing is. But at the same time, this is how he iterates really quickly and just feeds a bunch of ideas to other people who then tighten it up for client presentations. And then, of course, you have to get to this stage before you get to the final actual rendered thing. This obviously is not a Gehry building. And so I think that there's a lot of lessons there in terms of rapid iteration, staying really, really loose. Product design is an area where this is also very common. I have a secret desire and love for all things coming out of early phase industrial design. Really loose, not a lot of details, but it gets the point across. I draw one of those. And then the other thing is that they do a lot of stuff in 3D. God bless blue foam. This is something that we don't do. We're all starting to design more for devices. Why aren't we designing at one-to-one scale? Why aren't we actually doing little paper prototypes of devices more often to understand those issues of scale, especially at our company? We design like 70-inch plus multi-touch walls. Film and games is what, of course, a lot of people think about when they think about conceptual design, because this stuff is just cool. And, you know, this is, again, about massive, constant iteration around kind of a central core concept. Sometimes the fidelity level gets a little bit higher, but still, like, look at the marks. They're really loose. Gets the idea across. The other thing people don't realize is when you get into scenes like this, this probably took 1 to 3 days to paint. That's still several orders of magnitude less effort than actually lighting, rigging, and animating something like this. So this communicates the vision in a way that, sure, might be detailed on its own, but compared to the final actual effort, not so much. So they also do work in 3D as well. This is a work of a guy who works at Valve, and so they do maquettes and 3D sculptures. You're going to start to notice kind of a pattern here when I start talking about more and more 3D deliverables. We all know storyboarding, I think, from animation and motion graphics, but there's something that a lot of other people outside of this industry aren't familiar with, which are called design frames, which are basically higher fidelity storyboards, and that's what's used to kind of get the visual design language signed off. So a whole 30-second spot might just have four design frames to get the idea across. Again, much easier than animating this all the way through. So there are three steps, I think, that are very important in terms of looking at other industries and merging that into what we do, designing software. The first is step the hell away from your computer during this phase. Don't touch it. Don't push a pixel. Why? No one can iterate faster on a computer than they can with their own hands. This is an ideal design kickoff, in my opinion. In addition, I think that tools influence where you go, and computers are very exacting, and it will move you too fast too soon. This is the entirety of interaction design for a Surface application. We never made a digital deliverable. The prototype was actually what got sold, and then we mocked stuff up on paper. These were shot with an iPhone, and this totally got client approval on round one because it sold the vision, told in kind of a storyboard format. You can also just rip it off, do the exact same thing that other industries are doing. In interaction design, right now we do that quite a bit with storyboards. You'll notice this actually is broken down into scene, sequence, shot, exactly like an AV storyboard. We also do storyboards kind of leaning on other tropes, like the shaded marker style that we saw earlier in product design, just getting the idea that there's some volume, there's some detail, but it's not what it'll finally look like. And even when we do a final polished deliverable, still using those tropes of the storyboard to show animation and sequences over time. And again, coming back to 3D, coming back to working at scale and mocking up actual devices, the more and more that these become very common design targets for us. And finally, bastardize everything. We are process fiends at Stimulant, but we're never process purists. So this is an example of taking a real map out of my glove box, putting a whole bunch of paper on pins, and then taking it into Photoshop to further annotate it and color code it, etc. Design approval on round one. It did not imply what it would finally look like. The other thing that we do, again, is big, massive multi-touch screens. So we took over one of our conference rooms, and we started to realize, oh, wow, at 70 inches, we have massive ergonomic issues at 18 inches away from the screen. So what are we going to do? Well, we spiked out on the wall where the rotation points of the human elbow, where the human shoulders were, for male, female, adults, children, and even people in wheelchairs, which we actually role-played a little bit. And that adjusted where the screen wanted to be placed relative to the floor, which then, of course, ultimately, this didn't get shown to the client, but we just kind of cleaned it up and threw in an architectural elevation drawing. We're not designing the whole exhibit. We're designing what's on that screen. But this is really, really important context for you, for clients. So wrapping up, conceptual design really, at the end of the day, is about communicating your vision through deliverables by any means necessary. It can be rough. It can be physical. I challenge all of you to try to express interaction design through interpretive dance, if that helps. But it's all about communicating that vision to your clients and your internal stakeholders so everyone can have a design framework to make decisions around for the rest of your project. So we'll be around, obviously, at the end of the session with any questions. So thanks.
Check, check. Good. All right, so I'm Robert Tuttle, I guess now Chief UX Ninja from Frog Design. And let's take a little bit of a left turn here and talk about real-time sensor data visualization, definitely tactical, not conceptual. And a little quick overview about Fidgets. It's a hardware-based and software platform for getting access to controllers and sensors that deliver on things like pressure and force and light and temperature, et cetera. And then also a rich software API that's available in .NET and C#, and many other languages as well. And we actually use this platform along with complementary platforms like Arduino to deliver on augmented reality experiences that kind of connect shopping and physical form. And then at Frog, we also look way out into the future and do conceptual sketching around what sensor data might look like in daily life and how you might actually use that. But more recently, and as you saw probably at the end of today's keynote, we're using time of flight from the Kinect and other fidgets and Arduino to deliver on fun experiences as well. And this year's Frog hosted South by Southwest opening party, the theme of our event was playing with the time of light. And we use Kinects and fidgets and other sensor platforms to just make the party fun and have it be interactive for the interactive crowd coming to South by Southwest. The experience I'm going to focus on here today is the life-size step sequencer that we delivered, which is essentially a crowd-sized musical instrument that we took over a whole section of the warehouse and delivered really an immersive experience around audio, visual, and then also social experimentation. So the basics of a step sequencer, for those that don't know, is you have columns that represent the beats or the subdivisions of a beat in a loop, and then the rows represent different sounds or instruments that get triggered. So when you activate a cell, it puts that music into that slot, and then you'll hear that sample over and over. And so the more slots you turn on, you create dynamic samples. Quick context about the build-out. Here is a lot of the USB cabling and the fidget sensors, and literally a half a mile of wire that carried current and also data instructions. I happened to break out into some Silverlight out of box and constructed the whole UI in Silverlight 4. And then my colleague delivered on the, this is our root node, and here's a sample of the build out of the experience at the warehouse. A lot of cable and current. And as we were getting ready for the party, we just had to keep reminding ourselves that electricity, or this cabling, was object-oriented electricity. The result, though, was what we were targeting as a user experience was a combination of graphical UI, natural user interface, being able to step on a platform and trigger something in the experience, and then also the environment itself, the social interaction, the group collection of people trying to figure out how to make the right sounds, whether it was cacophony or if it actually was a really good groove. And what I'm going to show next here is a kind of a quick sample of the interactions from the party with the crowd noise filtered out, but the real music that was generated from the party experience. And here's the kind of the, you know, right before the we actually opened the gates, here's me doing some live testing here just to make sure we had things rigged up. And as people started to come in and explore the experience, we didn't really provide a lot of UI or a lot of instructions, so we really wanted that experimental, what is this thing all about? And then as the party started to flow, you had different users trying to figure out, okay, am I dealing with the lights? Am I triggering audio? Am I supposed to look at the UI layer? It was a random array of different user interactions, but literally a lot of fun. And I was just back playing DJ and kind of sampling through some of the different audio mixes for this experience. I actually had one guy come up and ask me, "Is this just a big social experiment? You're not really doing anything." And I actually had to break out the code and show him, like in real time, I was actually running it in debug mode, and it was just to prove it. But the one of the challenges and the opportunities with this experience was playing in the gray area between laws of physics and the human senses. This was as much about data oralization, what you were hearing, as it was data visualization. If the title of my talk misled you, this isn't about spark lines or generating live graphs. This is really simple data visualization of the floor and the lights and the visuals and the audio all kind of coming together to be the visualization of people stepping on the platforms. And one of the key parts of the experience that we had to get right was when you step on that platform, you trigger the light down below you, you trigger the light on the UI, and you hear your sound in the loop. And all of that had to be timed together so that you had a compelling experience for each person. Let me go into the tactical side or technical side just a little bit and kind of talk about some of the key elements of the architecture that I had to build out in order to enable this experience. So The platforms themselves were a combination of a force sensor and then LED lights that were either triggered from the force sensor through the software, or the blue lights were when your column was participating in that beat. So you really got that visual feedback. All of these 64 platforms were assembled into this grid, as you saw. And I think I actually found the first practical and valuable use of a netbook form factor, because we used that to stuff under the root hub, and it was using virtual Wi-Fi from Windows 7, which actually rocks, because we didn't have to use a separate Wi-Fi broadcast in order to have the DJ station separated, to allow it to be separated from the platform area. And then one of the other things that I get a lot is clients often ask, should we be switching to Silverlight in place of WPF? And the real answer is that I was trying to push the paces of what Silverlight could do with multi-threading, et cetera. All of that being said, the real value here was that we were delivering this immersive experience of visuals, music, lights, sensors, music sequencer, and then, of course, drinks that were flowing and having people were experimenting with the audio. And one of the key things that I think came out of this was we didn't really do any user testing ahead of time, so the party was our user test in order to validate whether this was an enjoyable experience. The inspiration for this came out of the audio tool that was delivered by Andre Michel in his Tonefall platform. In the UI layer itself, in the visuals, we actually chose to just keep it very simple and almost be a digital representation of what the users would see on the floor. So the concept of less was really more here, because the two things that we wanted to have as the primary outputs were the audio and the music and the loops and the mixing, and then also the interaction with the lights, et cetera. We didn't want to have the users distracted by looking at some flashy eye candy on the wall when it was really about mixing with the crowd and socializing to try to make different samples and different mixes. There is no amount of code UX Ninja that can protect you from the ravages of spilt beer or high heels. And so how you fail, and especially when you're dealing with real time, how you fail and recover from those types of calamities is more important than trying to build a bulletproof experience. So that UI on the wall was really our backup or our plan B. So when, as the night went along, some of the sensors, not the sensors, but the lights would fail, the users could still see their interaction with the UI and have that experience of being able to trigger the sound and get that feedback. And as we've come to work on in the desktop and web world, we deal with making our UIs feel performant or feel responsive in the face of lack of real time or high latency. So there is no spinning, there's no lazy loading, there's no caching that we have available. So again, the point about being able to stay relevant with your data and be concise is a really important key on delivering on real time. So in this case, we were really just sticking to binary, on and off. We didn't try to get too complex. I actually had the notion early on to maybe show the force weight data as part of the UI, but then I realized we actually want women to use this experience as well, because you can't really show that. And so there's also an appropriateness. So when you're dealing with human-based sensor data and human information, you have to be appropriate with as well. And honestly, besides that, we were already exploring the level of appropriateness or too much information in another part of our party experience. So we had that base covered. Didn't really have to go overboard there. But really, wrapping this up, what this experiment was about was not about trying to design or deliver the user experience. That's kind of a pet peeve of mine, is that there's no really the user experience. The best we could do in this situation was have some assumptions about our users, understand what their expectations were when they see these platforms or they see the environment, and then try to construct an environment and an experience that was comfortable to them and also really dynamic and created that social interaction. So it really was about trying to meet their expectations. One of the interesting things here is we didn't really consider the Z-index or the vertical plane, so we had people jumping up and down on the platforms thinking they could trigger experiences. But anyway, thanks very much. For more information about it, go to DesignMind.
Hi, my name is Guido Rosso. I'm the Chief Creative Officer of Archetype. And I'm here today to talk to you about prototyping interfaces with motion graphics. And typically when we think about motion graphics, we tend to think about Hollywood movies, video games, advertisements, MTV, and more of the like. And that may initially seem like a lot of fluff, but at the same time, it is really a lot about storytelling. And that's interesting to us as user experience designers, particularly in movies. For example, here you have some examples. And you can think of the retina scanner, where an actor might walk up to a device, they put their eye up to this device, and they wait. It's up to the motion designer to tell the viewer what's happening. And the motion designer will create some kind of looping animation telling the viewer that, hey, something's happening, something's being processed, and then a quick animation with harsh lines might tell you that something broke, it's red, you didn't get access, or a smooth animation with blue or green colors tells you that access was granted. So motion is also becoming more and more important in applications, and we see this a lot with the iPhone, we see this in mobile a lot, Windows Phone 7 as well has taken motion to new heights. It's becoming more and more something that we expect and becomes part of our experience. And similarly to the movie experience, you can think of something like a barcode scanner, where a user might hold something up to a barcode, and they expect something to be happening. But if nothing is going on, there's no animation, the user might think that the app is broken. Whereas if there's an animation, it's looping, the user knows to expect something else. Something else is coming. And again, this is part of storytelling. This is what we do as user experience designers, and it affects the usability of the app. So unfortunately, though, with applications, motion tends to be an afterthought a lot of the time. And it's unfortunately something that more times than not, developers need to interpret towards the end of your development phase. You know, how many times have you been at where you've gotten a prototype, it's fully working, and you're thinking, well, it'd be really great to add some animation or have some transitions. And that's a problem because it really limits your vision. It hampers forward thinking, and you end up with stuff that's really cookie cutter and really bland and boring or might not even have animations at all. So you don't want to let this stuff hamper your vision. And not only that, but you can also catch potential interactivity flaws, which I'll show a little bit about now in some videos that I'm going to show you guys. What these are motion prototypes that we develop in our company, Archetype. The first one I'm going to show you is the player skins that we did for the expression player. And the first thing you're going to notice is that these tend to be really short. And they're really short because, and not only that, but you can see how much we actually show in a very short amount of time. And this is something that happens right around after initial comps have been delivered. You could do it in wireframing. You could do it in paper prototypes. Wherever it is, I just encourage you to start doing more motion graphics earlier on. And as you can see here, for example, in this specific demo, there was a lot that we wanted to show early on before we started development. We wanted to show some of the new Silverlight 3D features in Silverlight 3. And so we didn't want to be limited, though, by what was possible with the technology or what had been done before. We really wanted to come up with a killer concept. And, you know, there's little things we're showing here, like glows on mouse over, drop shadows, and this is just going to keep looping. All these videos I'm showing you, again, they're very short, but you get a sense of how much you can actually show in something like this. And so you see that we really wanted to push the envelope with this, and we fortunately were able to create something that looked exactly like it. This is the motion prototype that you're seeing, but the final app looked exactly like this. It scaled, and those are things that also we tend to show. You know, scaling is an important one that you can show in motion in a way that you can't really show with static comps. I mean, yeah, you could do storyboards. You could have text descriptions and in your wireframes, but something like this is so much more powerful and gets the message across just a lot better than something that's not, than something static. The next one I'm going to show you is something that we did last year for Mix. This was the first Silverlight demo that was shown running on Windows Phone 7, and We basically got the project 2 weeks before Mix, and we locked design in the very first week, and this was done in about a day's worth of work where we wanted to show the motion. It was really apparent at the start of Windows Phone 7 that motion was going to be a really big part of it. But the devices that we had at the time, you know, Metro was clearly very proponent of motion and these kind of sweeping 3D views, but we wanted to do more with it, and we wanted to do it with Silverlight before controls were available, before a lot of this stuff was, you know, Microsoft now supplies panorama controls and supplies buttons, but a lot of this stuff wasn't available, and we wanted to make sure that we could get it to look the way we wanted it to before we actually started developing anything. And so this was a result of the initial comps. We threw everything into After Effects and started animating. Advertisements were something that was really important to them, as well as breaking news. And so we wanted to show how breaking news would pop up and kind of let you know, give a sense of urgency with that motion and animate and scale down and let the user know that, hey, there's something that needs your attention, but at the same time quickly hide away and not hamper the usability of the rest of the app. And likewise here, you see that there's a lot more depth to this motion than some of the earlier Windows Phone 7 that was being shown. And that was something that we really wanted to try to get working in Silverlight, to have more than just this kind of faked parallax UI or a system. And fortunately enough, a week later at Mix, we displayed this app in the keynote, and it looked exactly like this. And it was 100% built and running and working with their services. The next one I'm going to show you is a demo kit for Silverlight. This was also back at Silverlight 3 had just been launched. And we were trying to develop basically a gallery of really cool and compelling Silverlight projects. And we really wanted to show that Silverlight could do visually a lot of the cool, flashy stuff that other platforms could do. And again, something like this, you know, we started early with motion because we knew we wanted it to be really visually rich, to have a lot of animation. And as you can see here, the motion really kind of reinforces the whole movement of the site. The whole menu system comes out from the left. It slides over as the content appears. And that reinforces that your navigation is on the left. And as you click over there, content appears on the right. And the motion is really a huge part of this piece because you see in the background, you know, when you click on stuff, content slides in, the background animates in, it seeps into the interface, the colors affect the whole design. The interface itself here is black and white. The colors of the project are what are seeping through and affecting the whole interface here. And it would have been very hard to show a lot of the vision here without actually doing motion. And also, we were early enough where we hadn't actually needed to build any prototypes. We weren't so far into production that going back and changing any of this would have been a huge problem for us. And the final piece I want to show you, I just realized audio was off, is a sample iPhone app that we did. It was actually a concept that didn't get built. And here we're showing an app basically for Frontier Airlines. You see that you launch the app, your flights appear, you click on the flight that you're interested in going to, you click check-in, it shows you the gate you're going to, and you confirm your check-in, confirm your seat, and you get a barcode on the app that you can walk up to the boarding and essentially board your flight using your phone, where they'll just scan your barcode. And let me just play that one again. You can see that, again, this isn't, from a motion graphics perspective, this isn't a whole lot of work. We take the assets, we throw them all in, and we just do some simple transitions, simple animations. We try to make it really close to what the final product would look like, but we don't need to build the final product, and we give a much more powerful sense of what the actual final product is going to look like. This is really not only great for the client and helps you sell a concept in a much more compelling way, it's also good for your internal dev team to know, you know, this is what we really want it to look like. This is what the final app should behave like. If you know, things like graceful animation and tweening and timing of transitions can all be determined here and can be used as a reference point later on in development. So, in conclusion, would like to basically encourage you to start motion prototyping sooner. Whether you start doing it, at an early wireframing phase, whether you take screenshots of your paper prototypes, whether you do it with comps, something like this is really powerful. It helps you make a much more powerful initial concept. It can help you catch interactivity flaws early on, and it can help you develop something that's not limited by the technology that you're looking at using, but it helps you come up with something that's really, really advanced and really can really fulfill the vision of the designer without needing to be tied down to any specific technology. So thank you.